Do you know how much cash back you're leaving on the table for settling for the wrong credit card? Imagine earning up to 5% cash back on your groceries for the next 30 years. Just think of all that cash back you can get on those groceries. NerdWallet helps everyone make smarter financial decisions today, so the future you will thank you for it. With NerdWallet, you won't regret missing out on rewards. NerdWallet lets you compare smart cashback credit cards side by side to make the most of your everyday spending. So what could future you do with more cashback? A getaway with the kids? A spa day for yourself? Whatever it is, make it happen with a smarter cashback credit card. And don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Paying for college shouldn't be the hardest part of higher education. Hi, it's Rena Ninen, co-host of the Ask Lisa podcast. I recently spoke with U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona about FAFSA, the free application for student aid. Did you know you can apply for financial aid today and you'll get a response within 1 to 3 days? Check out our show notes to the link for the full interview on our Ask Lisa podcast YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe for the latest videos from Lisa and me. That's the Ask Lisa podcast YouTube channel. This is Ask Lisa, a podcast to help people understand the psychology of parenting now in the midst of a pandemic. Psychologist Dr. Lisa DeMore, author of 2 New York Times best-selling parenting books, takes your questions. And I'm co-host Rena Ninen, a journalist and mom of 2. Some of what we talk about comes from raising children ourselves. Most of the time, I'll be getting answers to your parenting questions. So send your questions to Ask Lisa at drlisademore.com. Episode 38, How Do I Teach My Kids About Consent? So it's so exciting to see teenagers that are able to get vaccinated. I kind of feel like it's going to be the summer of love for everybody.
You do feel that, right? That these teenagers have been so hemmed in. And finally, we are able to safely let them roam as they should. But yeah, I mean, if I were a teenager, I'd be like, man, I have some lost time to make up for.
Can't blame them. Really can't blame them. It's been hard for everyone. We got an incredible letter from a mom in Australia talking about consent, which made me think about all these things, conversations we need to be having as we're emerging out of this.
Right. And that we can finally have conversations about normal development again in a different kind of way.
So right, Lisa. So she writes here, Dear Lisa, I'm a huge fan of your podcast. Thank you for your wisdom and valuable parenting tips. My question is a big one. How do we teach our kids about consent when it comes to teen relationships? I live in Sydney, Australia. What should we say in our homes? There's a fine line between coercion and consent, and there are a lot of young girls who don't even realize they're being assaulted. And frighteningly, a lot of boys don't realize that sometimes what they're doing is assault. As a 40-year-old, I can't even wrap my head around this line of thought. When I was a teen, those stories existed, but they seemed to be few and far between. What's changed in the way kids view sex? Can we blame the rise of internet porn available to young minds 24/7 on their phones? Or is it just a lack of education, both in and out of the home? I would so love any wisdom and light that you can share on this. Thank you. First off, you know, where do you even begin as a parent?
Right? I mean, this is so high stakes and so important and so loaded and delicate and hard to even walk up to. So where I begin is kind of different from where a lot of people begin, which is I actually really don't like focusing on the word consent. I think there's problems with that. So of course, theoretically, I agree with it. Of course, no one should be expected to do anything in a physically intimate interaction that they have not agreed to. But the term consent is the lowest bar we could possibly articulate here. It is a legal term. It refers to, you know, if you are in court, was the relation, you know, whatever occurred, quote unquote, consensual? Did the person give permission? It is totally, in my mind, like a terrible standard for getting agreement in the bedroom, right? The idea that like I got permission is so low. Like the way I think about it, Rena, the term consent is totally appropriate for things like getting a root canal, right? Or, you know, agreeing to a surgery, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yes, like nobody really wants it, but you do have to give permission. The idea that that has become the focal word when what we're talking about are love lives and what should be mutual and enjoyable. I know it's well-intended when adults are talking about consent, but there's a part of me, every time I hear it, I'm like, I think we're part of the problem sometimes if that's where we're starting for where kids should be thinking about getting agreement for physical intimacy.
So what I hear you saying, you feel like this is the lowest bar because this is a term that you use with legal transactions, and a relationship is not a legal transaction,
no.
Or shouldn't be.
No, or I'll tell you exactly how I watch this translate. And this just, Rena, it just makes me so unhappy and so uneasy. One of the things I get to do in the pandemic, it's kind of a remarkable thing, is I get to go to schools virtually and I get to speak to students virtually, and students get to ask me questions through the chat. So I can see who asked, but I don't know these kids. And then I can read their question out loud without naming them and answer their question for everyone. And it recently occurred, not that long ago, that a student who was clearly female sent a question to me, and it was basically like, okay, what if you're hooking up with a guy and he wants to go further than you want to go, and you're not really worried for your physical safety, but you're afraid that if you say no, he's going to talk bad about you to everybody.
Oh, wow.
What should you do? And I was like, oh, my Lord, like, that's it, right? So So picture that scenario, and, you know, this is a heterosexual interaction, but these things go down, you know, girls press boys to do things they don't want to do. This happens in all sorts of, you know, romantic configurations. But picture that scenario where the boy's like, hey, let's do this. And the girl's like, And either implicitly or explicitly, he communicates that if you don't go along, if you don't give me consent, you're going to get trashed. You're going to be spoken badly of. So she might be like, okay, right? There's consent. Is that in any way what we would consider acceptable for that interaction? Like, not even by a mile. I mean, 100 miles.
So if you say this term consent is what you call like the lowest bar, how do you approach this conversation? How do you reach a higher bar? What is the appropriate thing to do?
Well, part of what we're up against are these norms. And I'll tell you exactly how I answered that question, because the question just blew me out of the water.
Yeah,
absolutely blew me out of the water. Because the way the kid was asking it was like this true dilemma, like this true sense of like, I'm stuck in this terrible position. And so I said two things. The first thing I said is, if you, any of you, are in a physically intimate relationship with somebody and they're pushing for something and you indicate hesitation, if you just, you know, if you even verbally or in any other way indicate hesitation, the only acceptable response from your partner is, hey, you're uncomfortable, or you're telling me you're uncomfortable, I sense you're uncomfortable, I don't want to do anything you don't want to do, right? That's the only acceptable response. But then I said to the student, and also all the students who were listening, the problem here is what you're describing has become very normed, that it's so standard, this idea, and it usually is boys get to press and girls are like, the boys are the gas in these physical relationships and girls are the brake, and we endow girls with the responsibility for regulating adolescent sexuality. I said, it's so normed that no one should be put in this position and no one should be within 10 feet of somebody who would put them in this position. And yet this has become so standardized that kids are finding themselves in these interactions in a way they absolutely, it just breaks my heart.
But Lisa, the reality is, teens find themselves in that situation and the guy doesn't say, oh my God, she's uncomfortable. In this moment of passion, I'm going to just completely stop and make sure she's okay with this. How do we change that? How do we change what you say is a conventional norm?
Well, that moment of passion piece, this, you know, I'm imagining, and it's hard to know exactly what goes down. You know, this writer asked about porn, and there is a part of me, as I've unfortunately in my work encountered stories like this, where it does feel like porn is starting to drive some of the script here.
Right.
Where either because guys have been watching lots of porn or they've picked up that script, it can feel, and I've cared for young women who have been in situations where it just feels like however they are expressing their refusal or their lack of interest, the train is like going and they cannot stop it. And there have been times when I have thought, is this fueled by a very, kind of hypercharged and also kind of, like we talked about in the porn podcast, like aggressive overlay that you see in porn. So there's that. So one thing you do, again, do what you can as a parent to shut down kids' access to porn. It makes nothing better, and I think it probably makes a lot of things much worse.
Hmm. So when you talk about consent, what does it actually mean? When we're having these conversations with kids about consent, it's this big legal term. What should we be telling them? You talk about this runaway train. You talk about any hesitation, you just stop. What do we need to be saying to our kids?
Well, I think we actually need to change the frame entirely. So among my many beefs with the term consent is also the idea of like it has this offense-defense quality to it. Like one person presses, the other person holds the line or gives in on the line. And that offense-defense framework really pervades a lot of how we talk to kids about sex. It sort of is there all the time. So I'll give you a for instance. We've long studied the talk, finger quotes, the talk.
Yeah.
And it turns out there's two different talks. There's the talk we give boys and the talk we give girls. And the talk we give boys tends to be like, dude, if you have sex, be sure to wear a condom. Like that's basically sums it up.
That's right.
And the talk we give girls is like, okay, don't get pregnant. Don't get an STD. Don't get yourself in a, tricky situation. Some adults say this. I don't say this. Don't harm your reputation, but reputation comes into this very heavily. But again, it's that like, boys, we just think you're going to be, kind of hog wild. And girls, you're in charge of keeping this under control. So that has been the framework. So the whole framework's problematic. So the framework I think we want to operate from as parents is physical intimacy is supposed to be nice, and it's supposed to be nice for everyone involved, and this should be joyful and pleasurable. Okay, this is not always comfortable for parents to be like, my kids' love life should be joyful and pleasurable.
Gosh. I don't want to talk to my kids about their love life.
I know, right? Or certainly through that frame. So I think part of what enters into this is our own adult widginess with the ideas of like kids, like, true. And especially, I hate to say it, and you know this is true, girls enjoying physical intimacy. Like, I think we really as a culture have a very hard time with that. We as parents have a very hard time with that. And so we default into this like gas and brakes mode, like, boys, you're going to do what you're going to do. Girls, you got to keep it under control.
Yeah.
As opposed to, hey, this should be really a wonderful thing. Physical intimacy is, on the short list of like life's joys and constantly renewable joys. And so if we walk into it with that framework, everything starts to get better.
This reminds me sort of about sexual abuse and the conversations that you just like, what age do you start talking to kids about when it's inappropriate to be touched in a certain spot, and that it happens at a very early age, like, as young as 2 or 3, making them aware that, okay, your parents can touch you here, your grandparents who watch you, maybe, setting those guidelines early on. But by the time they hit their teens, I mean, is that when you should be having these conversations? Should you start at elementary school? Like, what do you need to do?
It's interesting, right, to think about there is a developmental trajectory where we talk about your body and its privacy and your right to have privacy around your body. So, and I do agree with you. Those are conversations where we should start young, saying to kids, hey, your body's private and, especially the parts that would be covered by a bathing suit, those are very private to you. And I think, if anybody makes you uncomfortable, you should definitely let somebody know. Like, that is really critical. And I do wonder if that then can move that idea of becoming uncomfortable with the way someone wants to be with your body, if we could then extend that into how we talk with, fifth graders, sixth graders. I mean, it's fifth grade, actually, that kids start talking about crushes and romance. You know, that is 10 years old. Like, that's usually when it happens. And it's gone on like that for decades.
Yeah.
And so I think if kids share a little bit, and sometimes they do, about their, you know, 10-year-old crushes or whatever.
Yeah.
I think then we can start in a, like, a nice sort of slow beginning of, like, well, do you want to hold hands? Like, do you want to sit next to that person? And the magic word here, Rena, is want, right? That want is where, for me, that should be the center of gravity. Like, what do you want to have happen here? And for boys, we presume the want. And I think wrongly so. We presume all boys are, like, looking for sex all the time. That's not fair to them.
Yeah.
For girls, we presume no want. We erase that from the conversation.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back on the Ask Lisa podcast.
Stitch Fix sends style so good, you can feel it. They deliver all the confidence that comes from a truly amazing outfit without any of the work. You don't have to get into your car. You don't have to go through hangers and figure out what section to find what you're looking for. It's so simple. What my stylist does is they take my wardrobe to the next level. She shows me what works for me. She helps me discover new things that I like that I wouldn't have picked up if I was browsing online or even walking through a store. As the seasons change, you want different things. And when there are big events in your life that you want to dress up for, Stitch Fix has you covered. And I also love that I've got everyday staples from Stitch Fix that feel good on that I am constantly reaching for in my wardrobe. Style that makes you feel as good as you look. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/AskLisa. That's stitchfix.com/AskLisa. stitchfix.com/AskLisa.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
On Our Minds is a podcast about the teenage experience, made by teens for teens.
There's a lot on our minds, and talking about it helps.
On Our Minds Season 4 is produced by PBS NewsHour Student Reporting Labs in collaboration with KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Ask Lisa podcast. So Lisa, I want to go back to this letter because the parent asks, you know, what's changed in the way kids view sex? Can we blame the rise of internet porn? Is that a factor? I know you mentioned it earlier. What's changed? What do you think? You've been in this field for over two decades. How have you seen this change over the past 10 years or so?
I'm not sure it's changed, actually. That part of the letter, I had some questions, because this writer says, you know, this was rare when we were growing up, and now it feels more common. I'm not 100% sure that's true. I think if we were to go back historically and could, you know, magically see exactly, you know, what the data were on non-consensual interactions, I think it's got a long, strong history to be true.
Wow, sure. That's interesting.
I think we're talking about it a lot more. I think it is on the table a lot more. And there's also been a norming of guys acting like jerks as being sexually acceptable. I really feel that that has become something. I mean, just the way that kiddo asked me that question, it just felt like, so this is the deal. Guys do this. How am I supposed to interact? I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, this is not how it's supposed to be. And if you get a whiff of this, you should be, you know, running in the opposite direction. But the whiff of it has become so normed that to me feels new. This idea that guys are just going to be out of control and, like, we just got to manage it as women.
Hmm. I want to ask you also about alcohol, because that plays into it. What do we need to know about consent and alcohol, and what should we be talking about with our kids?
Okay, alcohol makes this whole thing that is so messy to start so much messier. So what we know, and we've got good research on this, you know, once alcohol is in the picture, either in terms of the person who's committing the assault or the person who's assaulted, if either party has been drinking, the chances of things going, you know, of there being an assault go up. And, you know, there's lots of ways to slice this, that the person who's drunk has bad judgment and maybe, you know, more likely to assault. You also can't really get consent from someone who has been drinking. So, you know, it gets very murky very fast. But it's actually an opening here, Rena, because kids do get drunk to have sex. I mean, drinking and sex there's a lot of overlap of those in teenagers. And that, for me, has been a way to get back to this idea that this should be fun and pleasurable. Mm-hmm. So when I've talked about it with teenagers, I feel like, guys, like, tell me, like, it's really interesting to me if you think that you need to get drunk to hook up with somebody. Like, let's think about why, because this should be really fun for you. And we don't usually get drunk to do fun things. Like, we don't, like, if you're like, Lisa, would you like some, you know, Ben and Jerry's ice cream? I wouldn't be like, oh yeah, let me get a little drunk first, you know, and then I'll do it. So to sort of start, I like to start from the perspective of, we have to even question why someone's drinking as a precursor to hooking up.
Why do you think that is?
I think they're nervous. Mm. I think they're scared. I think, you know, you remember, right? I mean, there's something kind of like charged and wonderful about like those early physical interactions. I think they're also kind of terrified. So I think drinking helps them with that. Honestly, we have some research, Rena. This is both totally shocking and not surprising at the same time. Sometimes girls, we have research showing the getting drunk helps them to protect their reputations. Might want to, you know, try sex or try something, you know, in the grand overlay of what is sex.
Yeah.
And yet they also worry that they're going to be slut shamed, which is a totally legit worry that young women carry around. If they drink, they can be like, well, I was drunk, right? So it becomes this solution to a horrible problem they should never in a million years be confronted with. But as soon as drinking's in the picture, this whole thing gets so messy and so much more uglier than it already was. And so that I do think we can say, like, if you need to get drunk to hook up with somebody, or if you are hooking up with somebody who's drunk, this is already a huge problem, because this is supposed to be a fun, pleasant, present experience. And alcohol is going to numb that. And you're not going to enjoy it as much as if you're drunk. And I think that's the part. If we can get around that corner as adults to say, look, this won't be as pleasurable for you if you've been drinking or your partner's been drinking. That's kind of jarring to kids and to grownups to shift into pleasure.
Mm.
But it does get us back to the want and the mutuality, which keeps kids safer, keeps kids much safer.
Mm. I also feel like alcohol is like this magic memory eraser that, okay, we've done it, we've, and then, okay, we don't have to pretend. It just can cause so many problems in teenager relationships, friendships, but it's hard to have that conversation to get your kids to understand the repercussions of once it's over, right?
That's right. And, you know, what you say about memory eraser, I think you're like totally on the button. There's so much shame caught up around sex and desire. And I think kids feel it, grown-ups feel it. And so alcohol enters that story as a character who kind of blurs it all, you know, and I think reduces some sense of shame, because it reduces some sense of overall experiencing anything. And I think if we can try to go after the shame aspect of this and really shift to this idea that young people are curious about physical intimacy, and young people are going to want to try physical intimacy, and we want them to enjoy it. We want to see it as part of healthy and normal development for them to engage in physical intimacy with their age mates. If we can take the shame away, we also probably reduce the chance that alcohol is part of the story.
Hmm. So Lisa, what's your advice for parents, right? What's the conversations we should be having that opens the door, that resonates, gets them to understand, especially in this moment in the pandemic, as things appear to be starting to open up and emerge, and we might be able to reclaim our lives back again as they were pre-pandemic.
Right. I mean, there's this, oh man, you can just taste it almost,
yes.
This sense of like life returning. So here's what I would do. Here's how I like to think about it. So if we toss consent, and if we toss the idea of the offense-defense framework, and if we toss the idea that there's one conversation for boys and one conversation for girls, I think what we're left with is four steps that we can articulate to kids. And I'll lay them out, and then we'll think about how this actually happens in real life. But the first is we want kids to center on, what do I want? Like, what do I want to have happen? Do I want to hold hands? Do I want to kiss? Do I want to sit really close? You know, or everything beyond that. So we want kids thinking first and foremost, what do I want? And especially, we want this for our sons and our daughters, but especially for girls. This is a conversation we need to be having. The next thing we then want them to know or think about is, and what does your partner want? And this is the part where we can weave in conversations about, you need to know that person. It's good to have enough of a relationship with that person that you can actually talk about this or find this out. If you don't know the person well enough to actually ask about what they want, you probably shouldn't be making out with them. You know, that's a good bar. And then the third step is, well, what do we both want? You know, in those Venn diagrams of I want this and you want that, where's the overlap? Where's that shared space? Want to do or want to try? You know, that's, you know, what we want kids to be focusing on, is that shared wanting. And then the fourth step is making sure that whatever we're both in agreement about, we do safely. You know, so if it's intercourse, you know, heterosexual intercourse, then we need, you know, or do we need to use contraception or, you know, prevent STIs or whatever. But that idea of first, what do you want? Then what does your partner want? Then what do you both want? And I will sometimes say to kids, I'm like, this is where grownups usually use the word consent. For me, way too low a bar. It should be what you want and your partner both want to have happen. And then doing whatever you want safely if needed.
This is great advice because it's so uncomfortable, no matter what age your kid is, to have a conversation about their love life. They're uncomfortable. You're uncomfortable. Nobody wants to have that conversation. But nobody wants to deal with the repercussions of what could happen.
No.
After a horrible situation.
And so I do think, like, in terms of how we weave this into family life, if we start small, you know, do you want to hold hands? Do you think that other person wants to hold hands? How would you find that out? That's, I think, how we put it on the ground in a conversational way in our family life. And then we can sort of take it up from there. As we hear kids talking about other kids, which they do, you know, and talking about other kids maybe being promiscuous as far as they're concerned or whatever, instead of joining in slut-shaming or, you know, whatever, we could say, do you think that's what she wants? Is she getting what she wants out of this? Is that what he wants? Is he accounting for what his partner wants? That we can just keep that word and that idea going of, want and shared want is the target. Consent is scraping bottom of gaining agreement, you know. And kids do press each other for agreement, and then they get agreement. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not okay.
Mm. Wow, there's so much from this conversation. If there's one thing that you want to get across to parents about this conversation on consent, Lisa, what would that be?
Kids care what we say. Kids do pay attention when their parents lay down values and express opinions. We know this from the research, actually, that when parents are very clear with their kids about what their expectations are and what their values and beliefs are, it does shape kids' behavior. And so early and often, I think we should be talking with kids about tuning into what they themselves want when it comes to physical intimacy, and then our total expectation that they will be highly attentive to the words and cues that come from anyone they're physically intimate with to make sure that that is also what that person wants. Be clear, it matters. there's no gray area really here. It is really, it gets gray fast, but I think there are places where we can be very black and white about it.
That's good to hear that kids really do care, because sometimes you feel like you're just talking to a wall, but to hear you as a psychologist tell us that they really do care what we say.
They do. They do.
They don't show it often, though.
It's true.
Lisa, this is so great. And we've got a wonderful giveaway that could be a fantastic resource for parents. Tell us more.
So Peggy Orenstein is a journalist and writer I've known for a long time, admired for a long time, know well personally. And she, among her many excellent books, has written two books. One is called Girls and Sex. The other is called Boys and Sex, where she brought the full force of her journalistic skills to understanding the landscape. And they're very current, very thoughtful interrogations of girls' experience of the sexual landscape, boys' experience of the sexual landscape. She gets deep into these questions about what goes down and how it goes down and, you know, what should go down instead. So let's give away one copy of each of those books, and listeners can enter for the one or both that they'd like to win.
That's great. I love the books that you find for us and bring to us, especially the latest releases and the current ones that you are always presenting, because we just need more resources as parents, and there's certain issues that resonate more with parents. So thank you. This is really terrific.
You bet.
And what do you have for us for Parenting to Go?
Well, actually, Rena, riffing off of what you were saying about, like, it's good to hear the kids are listening because you get the impression that they're not. I love eye rolling. I think
really?
It's like one of the most
fascinating. It
totally drives parents nuts. I think it's fascinating. I think it serves multiple purposes. I think it's really interesting. I also think that it is a way that kids can thread a very tricky needle of taking in what a parent is saying, but also seeming to rebuff what the parent is saying at the same time. So here's what I mean. If you were to say to your kid, okay, let's have this conversation, and then you lay down the whole sex thing that we just talked about, and they were to say, wow, I am so glad you brought this up. Like, this is so, I've been wondering what your values were and your perspective were on this thing. Okay, that would be super weird.
Yeah.
So if you say all these things and they roll their eyes, I think the way that parents should receive that is, I heard you. And you can tell I heard you because my eyes are rolling, which means I heard the words you said. And parents should be very satisfied with that because it lets the kid not be super weird about it. Like, oh my God, I can't believe you're talking about this. Doesn't mean they did not hear it. It means that the, oh my God, I can't believe you're talking about this, either verbally expressed or eye-rollingly expressed, is their way of taking some of the intensity out of a situation that's hard for them too.
A new way to look at things that drive parents crazy.
Exactly.
Thanks, Lisa. I'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week.
Thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Ask Lisa podcast so you get the episodes just as soon as they drop. And send us your questions to AskLisa at drlisademore.com. And now a word from our lawyers. The advice provided on this podcast does not constitute or serve as a substitute for professional psychological treatment, therapy, or other types of professional advice or intervention. If you have concerns about your child's well-being, consult a physician or mental health professional. If you're looking for additional resources, check out Lisa's website at drlisademore.com. We'll see you next week.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.